Roy Cohn, bully, coward, victim. Maybe you recognize his name or his picture, or maybe you've never heard of him. But whether or not you know who I'm talking about, I bet you're wondering how I got away with choosing some guy as my late 20th century topic in US history worthy of a final project. Let me explain. Roy Cohn's life starts out pretty unhistoric eventful. He was born in 1927 in the Bronx to Dora Cohn and Albert Cohn. Dora came from a rich family. She followed Cohn to summer camp every year and lived with him until her death. Albert was a hotshot judge who played a big role in Democratic Party politics and in his son's career path. Essentially, Cohn was born with a silver spoon in his mouth and overbearing parents on either shoulder. After attending the Horace Mann School, Fieldson School, Columbia College, and graduating from Columbia Law at 20 years old, Cohn had to wait until his 21st birthday, in 1948, to be old enough to be admitted to the bar and become one of New York's most promising lawyers. In another era, this could have been the end of the story for Roy Cohn, but the 50s in America was a hotbed for history. The Cold War and communism terror fears were in full swing, the House Un-American Activities Committee was a decade old, and Joseph McCarthy was coming into his prime. Ronald Reagan was campaigning for Truman in the 1948 election, and Donald Trump was in diapers. Pair this age of controversy with a character as complex as Roy Cohn, and you'll end up with a man whose influence spans several decades of hot-button issues, Republican politicians, and LGBT history. So, it's 1951, and 24-year-old Roy Cohn is entering the spotlight. He's just landed a killer case, the Rosenberg trial, and he's about to make a pretty big name for himself. In the still-controversial trial, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were convicted and sent to the electric chair for communist ties and spying on behalf of the Soviet Union during the Manhattan Project. The Espionage Act was the nail in their literal coffin. This case was a landmark moment in America's anti-communist attitudes and in young Cohn's career. He loudly and effectively campaigned for the pair's execution, and in doing so, he caught the eyes of J. Edgar Hoover, then FBI director, and Joseph McCarthy, the Wisconsin Republican senator, causing quite a commotion in the White House. For his anti-communist devotions, Cohn was made chief counsel to McCarthy, and by extension, chief architect of McCarthyism. Senator McCarthy believed without source or hesitation that the federal government and other major spheres of U.S. influence, like Hollywood, were full of communists. McCarthy was an alcoholic failure at this stage in his career, and he was declaring that communists were loyalty risks to the U.S. government. McCarthyism was a quest to purge the government of communists, which required great lawyers for its damning trials, and Cohn stepped into this role easily. He loved a good character assassination. One of his trial subjects in these hearings committed suicide after Cohn's ruthless pressure in court, and to Cohn that felt like a real win. Basically, very few of the hundreds imprisoned by HUAC, 10 to 12,000 who lost their job or job aspects by their court orders, and countless others who lost careers and lifestyles through the scandal of their subpoenas, were even remotely communist. They were directors, House representatives, actors, journalists, people who joined and left the Communist Party in the 40s for the social scene, and people who just pissed Cohn and McCarthy off. This era is America's second Red Scare. Though McCarthy chose his targets and methods, as his chief counsel, Cohn carried out many of the hearings and personally destroyed thousands of careers. The 50s in America. Communists were considered a loyalty risk, and homosexuals were considered security risks. As the second Red Scare tore through the Senate, the lesser-known Lavender Scare grew in parallel. Cohn was even more passionate about this cause. The Lavender Scare was the purge of gay people from the U.S. government, as they were perceived as mentally ill and inferior. They had no foreign ties, no espionage accusations, no prior indictments. They were federal workers and homosexuals, and therefore they were Cohn's main targets. It's hard to pin down the number of Lavender Scare victims. Being out in the 1950s was a career death sentence, a social death sentence, and sometimes a literal death sentence. You can't exactly cross-reference gay men employees in the 50s and HUAC victims because gay men in the 50s who worked in government were exclusively in the closet. You can read trial notes and journal entries, but you can't quantify the extent of the tragedy. But the Lavender Scare raged on. Until a U.S. Senate censure in 1954, fears of communism and homosexuality allowed Cohn and Hueck to thrive. With the help of Hoover, who'd set up the Rosenberg case and been influential in nativism following World War I, the duo had free rein in their hearings. McCarthy actually died 3 years later and left his protege to carry on their ruthless reputation alone. But by this time, Cohn was pretty much done with the classic lawyer role, mostly because he was pretty bad at it. He was sloppy, angry, and foolish in the courtroom, but his aggression was a force to be reckoned with in the world of power brokers. Power brokers influence people to vote or work for their clients in exchange for political or financial favors. They pull strings, they rig elections, and manipulate power. And Cohn was great at it. He mastered New York's favor bank, the local group of interconnected influence peddlers, and its ability to manipulate the rich and powerful. The job was in his blood. The favor bank helped make his father, Al Cohn, a Bronx County judge and later a state Supreme Court judge. In high school, Cohn was pulling favor bank strings to vanish teachers' parking tickets and boost his grades. He played the game well and acquired many clients, including Yankees owner George Steinbrenner, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese of New York, suspected mafia bosses Carmine Galenti and Fat Tony Salerno, and Louis Rosenstiel, who, excuse my tangent, was a multimillionaire who Cohn visited at the hospital while he was semi-comatose. Cohn held Rosenstiel's semi-comatose hand to sign a document naming Cohn a co-executor of Rosenstiel's will after falsely telling him that the document dealt with his divorce. There were a lot of situations like this for Cohn, and eventually these stunts would get him disbarred in 1986 for dishonesty, fraud, deceit, and misrepresentation. He was indicted 5 times on charges ranging from extortion and blackmail to bribery, conspiracy, securities fraud, and obstruction of justice. But he had been acquitted each time and began to behave as if he were above the law. And before that, Roy Cohn would become a frequent guest at the Reagan White House and a constant presence in Studio 54. And eventually, he'd even become Donald Trump's mentor. In 1973, Donald Trump was 26 and having a horrible day. He and Cohn both wound up at Le Club, a hangout for rich people, where randomly Trump turned to Cohn at the bar and asked his advice about Justice Department allegations that his real estate company had discriminated against black tenants. And Cohn advised, quote, "Tell them to go to hell." Cohn immediately became Trump's personal lawyer. Cohn served as a mentor to the businessman, helping him navigate the world of New York's power brokers. He even introduced him to the political strategist Roger Stone, a self-proclaimed dirty trickster who advised his presidential campaign. And their relationship was important to both of them. During the first month of Robert Mueller's investigation into Donald Trump's alleged corruption, the president blurted something out to his White House advisors. "Where's my Roy Cohn?" Trump was in his 20s and thriving when he met Cohn, who fed off his fame, and the pair dominated Manhattan with Cohn's backhanded deals and risks. Cohn taught media manipulation with the ideology that any publicity is good publicity. Trump's 80s tabloid stents are legendary, and so are his current tweets. And so is the duo's relationship, honestly. Trump kept a picture of Cohn in his pocket at all times, and in exchange, Cohn left the young man with his legacy and inevitable taint. Cohn is a lawyer accused of working against the law. He's an infamous thief. He helps his defendants commit crimes with his extensive knowledge of the law. Some believe his trickster mindset shapes the Trump era. Some believe it shaped American politics and the upper class systems as a whole. From Hoover to McCarthy, from Reagan's to Truman to Trump, Roy Cohn dominated the back alley world of government. Not a great guy, also not a simple guy. I heard about him from a play, actually. Roy Cohn is the subject of a main character in Tony Kushner's 1991 Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Angels in America, A Gay Fantasia on National Themes. In drama class, we've studied and performed scenes from the play, where Cohn seduces young men and eventually dies of AIDS. That character did not line up with the homophobic man I saw in Trump-Cohn-related news briefings. I needed to learn more about this contradiction, and I needed to do a history final project, so I looked into Cohn's life. After the Lavender Scare and McCarthyism and power brokering through scandal after scandal, Roy Cohn died of AIDS in 1986. He died a closeted gay man who called his AIDS diagnosis liver cancer publicly. Ronald Reagan was famously slow to take action during the AIDS epidemic, but he helped Cohn secure an experimental treatment after his diagnosis before releasing any treatment options to the public. And this, perhaps, is one of Cohn's greatest failures. His private access to AIDS treatment, which came as a result of being Nancy Reagan's friend, helped him survive as a gay man while he trashed and abandoned the rest of the gay community. And he called the diagnosis liver cancer to avoid the shame of his contradictions. The AIDS Memorial Quilt is a powerful visual reminder of the AIDS pandemic. More than 48,000 individual 3x6-foot memorial panels, each commemorating the life of someone who has died of AIDS, have been sewn together by friends, lovers, and family members. The quilt is massive and beautiful, and pieces of it actively travel the country, staying in schools, museums, and exhibitions to remind us of the losses of the AIDS crisis. 48,000 panels. A decade after Roy Cohn's death, approximately 6,400,000 people had died of AIDS worldwide. At the time, approximately 22,000 people in the world were living HIV positive. That's more people than the total population of Australia. Roy Cohn has a panel on the memorial quilt to honor his death from AIDS. It simply reads, Roy Cohn, bully, coward, victim. He's a complicated guy. He's 20th century historic U.S. event complicated. Thanks for listening.